Tomorrow is National DNA Day. Who knew there was such a thing? It commemorates the discovery of DNA's double helix in 1953. And here to celebrate DNA and all things in forensic science is one of the attorneys in Chicago most knowledgeable about the issues of forensic science and its use in the courtroom, Brendan Max. Brendan has been with the Cook County Public Defender's Office for 25 years defending indigent defendants, but currently he is the chief of the Forensic Science Division. Thank you for coming on, Brendan. How are you?
Hey, Karen, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me back and for celebrating National DNA Day. Very exciting.
It is exciting. I think we watch forensic files and we watch all these cases get solved with fingerprints and trace evidence, and we're fascinated by it. But you, as your job working for the Public Defender's Office, tell us a little bit, first of all, what you do and in that role when it comes to the public defenders in Cook County.
Yep. So at the Public Defender's Office in Chicago, we're lucky enough to have a forensic science division. I'm the chief of that division. And myself and a team of seven attorneys, we are really tasked with investigating forensic evidence that's used by police and prosecutors in search of conviction of Chicagoans. And our job is to look in and investigate the reliability of that forensic evidence. And at times, challenge that evidence when it's not reliable. The sad fact is that the criminal justice system has a really bad track record of being able to ferret out itself unreliable forensic evidence. There's a long history of bite mark evidence, hair comparison evidence, shoe print evidence, and a ton of other evidence kind of coming into evidence first and not till after the fact that the criminal justice system asks itself, is this really reliable enough for us to rely on it to convict people. So in Chicago, it's the task of myself and the attorneys who work with me to do that investigation up front and make sure that we don't add to the tally here in Chicago of people who have been convicted based on really questionable forensic evidence.
And there's been a lot. And, you know, I guess the point, too, is that, you know, jurors want that DNA. They want that hard evidence. They are used to seeing it on the shows that we watch, and they believe it. They believe in it. They think it's infallible. And as you're going to talk a little bit about this, it's not. And although it's good at convicting and good at finding the perpetrator, it's also good at convicting the wrong people if it's not properly used or not, you know, in some ways faulty. So let's start with the issue that you wanted to talk about, which is ShotSpotter. Can you tell? It's been installed in about 110 American cities. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about it if they don't know what that is?
Yep. So ShotSpotter is essentially a computer algorithm, a computer program, and what its job is to do is to listen in certain Chicago neighborhoods for the impulsive sound of a loud noise that might be gunfire. There are sensors that are set up in neighborhoods. They're on streetlights and on top of buildings. And those sensors listen for noises. They send data about those noises back to a headquarters in California. And then what ShotSpotter does, it's a private company. It's a private for-profit company. What it does is it has a computer code, an algorithm. And that algorithm attempts to determine whether that noise that was heard in a Chicago neighborhood, whether it originated from gunfire, and if it did, it attempts to kind of estimate the location of that noise event. And now the scientific concept is pretty straightforward and simple. If this were done in, like, you know, a wide open cornfield in southern Illinois without a bunch of complex urban noises, you know, this system could function pretty well in theory, but the question and the problem is, in Chicago, how well does a system like ShotSpotter function in attempting to discern just the noise of gunfire when there's so many other noises that both mimic gunfire and that we know from the research trigger false alerts with ShotSpotter? In fact, what the city inspector general, the Chicago inspector general, found last year is that about 90% of the time when ShotSpotter alerts police to respond to a location of what they say is gunfire, about 90% of the time police get there right away and encounter no real evidence of gunfire, meaning no victim, no witnesses, no fired casings, no bullets, no nothing. And it really raises the question of how accurate and reliable is this system. And when we started digging into it about a year or two ago, when I started representing a guy named Michael Williams, who was charged with murder in Chicago primarily on the basis of ShotSpotter evidence, what we found out was not only was this system never proven to be reliable before Chicago implemented it and paid tens of billions of dollars to run it, but that it had this really bad false positive problem. And in fact, there were a number of police agencies around the country who started using ShotSpotter before Chicago and then who discontinued use after they found that ShotSpotter was being triggered on false alerts from everything from traffic noises to construction noises to weather to all kinds of innocent fireworks. All types of innocent noise would trigger these false alerts by ShotSpotter. So it's a pretty controversial method that's being used.
I mean, clearly the purpose is we want to conserve our resources because God knows we need as many resources as we can because of the crime in Chicago. So we want to make sure that the police are deployed to as quickly as possible when there's a gunshot. But so what is the downside of having a system like this that are we saying that this is wasteful because police are being deployed to these scenes and it could be that it was just a car backfire or a garbage can noise or something? And are there bigger problems with it?
Yeah, so there's a number of problems. One is that when police get ShotSpotter alerts, what they are then primed for is that they're primed for that they're going to encounter a potentially violent situation, right? They've been alerted that ShotSpotter says that there's gunfire. And that then affects the interaction of those officers with the citizens of Chicago that they encounter. Because what they're doing is they're encountering citizens who are kind of walking down the street who aren't engaged in any criminality that they can see. But those citizens are being stopped, searched, and sometimes arrested based on the belief that this gunfire alert was real. So it does create a dangerous situation, number one, where police respond to neighborhoods thinking that there's, a dangerous incident of gunfire when it just might be traffic noises or construction noises. So that certainly poses a risk to not only to citizens, but to police officers, right? Because you have them scrambling around the city according to the OIG report, in an 18-month period, 50,000 times. And over 40,000 of those times, they weren't encountering real evidence of gunfire. So it really creates a dangerous situation on the streets of Chicago. I mean, there are other problems, that are more policy problems that have to do with funding and whether this is the right use of resources. But
Brendan,
it's a dangerous situation.
Yeah, no, I get it, for both police and citizens. Let's take a break, and when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about maybe the genealogy technology that we have and touch DNA and sure. Possibility of solving some of the cold crimes in Chicago. We're here with Brendan Max of the Cook County Public Defender's Office, and I'm Karen Conti, and you're listening to WGN. We're talking about forensic science with Brendan Max from the Cook County Public Defender's Office. He is the chief of forensic science there in that office. We got a lot to cover. So, Brendan, we have all these different technologies, fingerprints, firearms examination, DNA, and all these other types of evidence. And there was a study that was done out of Washington, D.C. that sort of cast some not so good light on some of the accuracies. And can you just kind of bullet point some of the things where these kinds of technologies actually go wrong?
Yep. So it all came out as a result of some problems with the D.C. crime lab. What they found there initially was they had problems with ballistic identification. So comparing casings at a crime scene to either a gun or another crime scene to try and identify the gun that fired those casings. What they found in the case that triggered the D.C. crime lab problem was that five different examiners there examined two casings, said that they were fired from the same gun and connected different crime scenes, when in fact those casings were not fired from the same gun. And what it highlights is, and what we're learning more about all the time, is just the subjectivity and uncertainty in a lot of forensic methods, something that maybe we weren't so aware of maybe 10 years ago. But between these crime lab problems and some other studies, what we've learned is that all these forensic methods that were thought to be like completely reliable or 100% accurate are subjective, and there's uncertainty there. So fingerprints, ballistic comparison, even DNA, where there's lots of subjective decisions that have to be made by examiners, errors can happen. And that's kind of the big message from not only the D.C. crime lab problems, but some of the problems with other crime labs around the country.
And you see this all the time in some of these shows. In fact, I was watching one last night where a guy was supposed to be an expert in it was footprints, and he had no expertise at all. And he was given full range to just opine that this was exactly the same shoe, and it put this guy in jail. And of course, 10 years later, it finds out it wasn't even close to the same size, let alone the same brand or anything. So, I think that is a point to really focus on, is that who are the real experts here and what are their qualifications? And we need to make sure that those are good qualifications. Otherwise, we have the wrong person in jail and the other person out committing more crimes. Quickly, touch DNA. Can you tell us a little bit about that and about how it helps and how it can sometimes go wrong?
Yeah, it's a really interesting and promising technique. So a number of years ago, it would take like a full blood stain at a crime scene to generate results. And when you got results from that blood stain, it would be very informative of kind of what happened there. But the issue is that these DNA machines have become so sensitive now that they can generate a DNA profile from just a few skin cells. The thing is, we all shed millions of skin cells as we walk around in our daily life, and we're all leaving detectable amounts of DNA behind us. And the issue now is, when you recover, let's say, a few skin cells from like a gun handle or a hat left at a crime scene or a door handle on a car, how meaningful is that, even if you can identify the person who belonged to the DNA? Because what we know now is that your DNA can remain in environment long after you were there. And what we also know is that your DNA can transfer from you to somebody else to another object quite easily. There's some real interesting studies that say, like, Karen, if you shake hands with me and then I touch a knife, we're as likely to find your DNA on that knife as mine. And when you're dealing with touch DNA and all you need is a little bit, what happens is that type of transfer situation becomes more common. And what it does is it confuses the meaning of the evidence sometimes. And the criminal justice system has to step back and say, I know we have a DNA profile here, and I know it's off this hat or this gun or this door handle, but do we know how it actually got here? We have the technology now to identify it. We have to start second guessing, how did that DNA get there and what does it actually mean?
Yeah, good point. You and I have talked about this before. One of the cases, the cold cases in Chicago, that just amazes me that we haven't found the perpetrator is the Lane Bryant case. And this was the 2008 murder of five women in the Brookside Marketplace Mall in Tinley Park. It appeared to be some sort of robbery gone awry, but we had a really good description of the person who committed the crime, down to the braids in his hair and the jacket he was wearing and the jeans he was wearing. Tell us, just again, not focusing particularly on this crime, but on a crime like this, where all this time has gone by and we don't know who this person is, what new technology could the police and the investigators be using? And we only have a minute, but could you just kind of bullet point some things that might help us out in solving this crime?
Yep, there's always hope for older cases. They're solved all the time. And some of the best ways to do that are, number one, the databases that open fingerprint and DNA are compared to, those databases are always growing. There's always more people being added. So if, let's say, in the Lane Bryant case, there were DNA or fingerprint profiles that were generated, those can be registered in these databases. They can sit in those databases. And over the years, as more people are entered, it sometimes happens that there's a hit and we can identify a suspect. There's also other technology on the horizon. Some DNA technology is starting to be able to not just identify like the numerical DNA profile of the person, but to generate information about what that person looks like. So I don't think we're quite there with that yet, but we will get there. And so there could be a DNA sample from a scene that could not just give us this numerical profile, but it could give you information of the appearance of the potential perpetrator. So those are sources of forensic evidence that still give investigators hopes, even in cold cases. Sometimes they're solved 20 or 30 years later.
Brendan Max, thank you so much for joining me. You've been listening to Brendan Max, who's with the Cook County Public Defender's Office. He is the chief of the Forensic Science Division. Have a great day and happy DNA to you, DNA Day to you and to everybody out there.
Thanks a lot, Karen. Appreciate it.